Radio.
This is the Q&A from Archbishop Anthony Fisher's talk, My Vision for Sydney, from Theology on Tap, held at La Pog in Sydney's CBD.
You spoke a lot about your faith in Sydney and the faith in Sydney. I just wanted to know, where do you see the big challenges that we're going to face over the next 20 years? And how can we overcome it?
I pointed to a few of the challenges in my talk, and I bet every one of you could name a few more that you're experiencing yourself. I think in the whole area of relationships, marriage, family, love, sex, commitment, sacrifice, that's a big area of challenge in our culture at the moment. I think in the area of the credibility of the church over issues like child sexual abuse, that's something we have to confront very directly and show people we can be trusted and we should be trusted. And that means we've got to be better than we've been sometimes in the past. I think we could point to other ones. I mentioned in my dream of the future that in 2035 it will be unthinkable to kill an old or dying person. Well, we know right now in our culture there's lots of people that think we should do just that. So we've got some real challenges about reverence for each other and respect for people who are sick or who are crippled in some way or who are suffering or are depressed. I think we have Catholicism, Christianity is not the only great idea competing for the human soul at the moment. Radical Islamism is very, very publicly and obviously at the moment in the world at the moment, and a kind of weak, lazy, complacent secularism is also. There's at least three big ideas competing for our souls at the moment, and that, I think that battle's going to go on for this whole century. You can each point to other challenges, I think, but there's a few. What's to be done about it? I think that program of those three great popes that we've known, the only three we've known, John Paul's challenge to us to stand for truth in our world, and Pope Benedict's challenge to stand for beauty, and Pope Francis's challenge to stand for goodness. If we can be all three of those things for our world, I think we'll be an antidote to so much of that, and we'll offer people such a better way, such a way of being happy and holy and fulfilled, that they'll say, wow, that's what I want. I want that for me. I want that for the people I love.
Happy New Year, Your Grace. Yesterday began the year of consecrated life. So could I ask, are there any plans yet for how that might be expressed in Sydney? And also, can we expect a few new religious congregations in Sydney by 2035?
How are we going to celebrate the year for consecrated life in Sydney? I'm having a mass with the consecrated people of Sydney this week, and then I'm going to ask them what are their ideas. But I'd love to hear your ideas too. When we had a year of the priest a few years ago, one of the things we did was in every parish, lay people, including young lay people, just went to their priests and told them they valued them, they loved what they did, that it mattered. And you might say, well, come on, you get enough encouragement. But actually, we get beaten up quite a bit this time in history. That's a simple thing you could do for religious, just to encourage them. Tell them they matter. Tell them you value what they do. But I think there's lots of things we could do to be showcasing religious life better, so that young people know the possibilities for their future, to be renewing religious life better, which the Vatican Council called us to do, to be more authentic religious, to be true to our particular inspiration and the inspirations of all religious. I hope we're going to have lots of ideas on how to do that in Sydney, and I've certainly got some of my own. Are we going to have new religious orders? Well, I look just here, and I see three that I managed to drag to Sydney one way or another in the last few years with help from my friends. Cardinal Pell's got a bit of pulling power. And I'd love to see 33 new religious orders by then flourishing in our diocese. Homegrown ones as well as the best and the brightest from around the world. There's every reason why we can expect that to happen, because Young people of idealism are there in every generation. The Holy Spirit doesn't abandon any generation. He inspires the people we need to be exemplars of holiness and to be leaders and servants that we need in every generation. So there are religious here, right now, religious to be, religious who are being called by God, and there'll be others that follow after you. 2035, there's going to be lots of new ones ahead.
Hi, Pope Francis has asked for a poor church for the poor. What's your vision for the Archdiocese of Sydney to follow this?
I said to you that I really hope by 2035 that our outreach to the needy is much more obvious and much more effective. I think that sometimes we can risk being just used to doing the same things that we've always done, or we can be carried along with doing the government's work for it, almost becoming a department of the government. And as the last three popes have said to us again and again, there are things that only people of faith can do. But you can't ask a government department to love you. You can't ask a bureaucrat to love you in your poverty, in your need, in your pain, in your struggle. But you can expect people who are the hands and mouth of Christ to love you, who are the heart of Christ. So there are things only we can do for the neediest people in our society. There are things only we can do for the refugees, the ones that are lucky enough to get here and not being pushed away. There are things only we can do for the poorest people or for people with disabilities of one kind or another, physical, emotional, psychological, or for people who, for other reasons, are on the margins. And Pope Francis keeps challenging us, look to the margins, look to those people that are really most in need of your love. I think there's much more we could do, and I'm very confident your generation, with your idealism, are going to help me to lead to do that.
Thanks. Hello, Your Grace. Hi. You talked about the importance of the Catholic school system and how wonderful it would be if, you know, we could have people coming out of those on fire. Do you have any particular priorities for how we're going to, or how we would achieve that through our system, what changes you'd like to see throughout in our Catholic schools during your time here?
I love our Catholic school system. I think it's one of the great achievements of the Church in Australia. There are very few countries in the world that have a resource like the Catholic school system in Australia. There's nothing like it in America or in Britain or in many comparable societies to ours. But I also think it has so much still untapped potential. I think we could be doing so much more to educate in the faith and form our young Christian leaders and servants of the future through our Catholic school system. And so I want to see our Catholic schools really being houses of prayer where people are taught to pray, to get into the rhythm of prayer so it's just ordinary life, it's every day, it's what I'm going to be for the rest of my life, where people are taught their faith and are ready to teach that to others, ready to share that with others, where people are given a vision of the good life that includes making a more just and compassionate society, giving a lead, serving in different ways. I think we're doing some of that. We could do all of that better. And I want to do my part as a leader in this part of the church to ensure we do it better. But in the end, I can publish all the mission statements in the world, great curriculum, great documents, great speeches from the bishop, but it depends hugely on the people on the ground, on the teachers and the leaders in the schools. And that means I need some of you to be great Catholic school teachers and Catholic school leaders, because that's the way we're going to make the potential of the Catholic school system really bear the fruit it should do.
Your Grace, I'm a member of the Catholic Society at Sydney University. And Your Grace, as a former student at Sydney University, you are well aware of the pervading culture of secularism at the institution. You debated Dr. Philip Nitschke, the euthanasia doctor, 11 years ago. Your Grace, what is your vision for university students? And maybe some advice for me at a secular university.
Okay. First thing I'd say is you're so lucky to be university students. Love it. Enjoy it. It's such a precious time of your life. A time where you can where people give you a bit of space to think, give you a bit of space to speculate, to argue about things, to read the great books, to think the big ideas, to ask the big questions. We should do that all our life, but there's a special time that's actually dedicated to that, and that's called university. And make the most of that. Ask the big questions and have the big debates and really make the most of your time there. And that includes taking on the secularists or the euthanasists or whoever, in your way, whichever your way is, like I tried to do as a student and then later when I came back here as a bishop. Bring to the university your passion. Your passion for the faith, your passion for what's good and true and beautiful. Don't let those forces around you, the desire to be popular, the desire not to look a fanatic, don't let that close you in so that you're afraid to show the real light in you, what excites you, what your passion is. Share that with people. Okay, a few of them will write you off and say, oh, there's another religion nerd or there's some kind of Catholic Jehovah's Witness or whatever they're going to call you. Well, fair enough, you know. Some people did that with Christ, didn't they? They just weren't interested. They walked away. But some people will find it magnetic if you let them see that this really matters, that you've got something beautiful to offer that is your faith. And don't be ashamed of that at university. Be really proud of that. Encourage each other too. That's the third thing I'd say. It's great that you're in a Catholic society. You're actually giving each other encouragement so you don't feel alone, you don't feel weird being religious, being idealistic. Actually, you know, look around this room, there's lots of people just like you. And it's helpful to see that by doing things together and having each other's encouragement and support.
Yeah, thanks for your talk, Your Grace. I just wanted to know, a lot of people say that the church does good, the church does this, etc., with the church doing a lot of good work that it does. But whenever something goes wrong with the church, example, abuse scandals or something goes wrong, it's the result of one man. So when, as Catholics, do we define the church, and when do we define the actions of one person or a group of people?
I think that's a very good question. I think a lot of us feel that intensely at different times. Why do I have to wear what he did or what she did? A few things I'd say about that. The church is Jesus Christ. He is the head. He is the foundation. It's his body. It's his destiny that we're incorporated into. And St. Paul once observed that if you mess up, and he was talking about people messing up sexually, you're involving Christ. You're, as it were, taking Christ into the prostitute's bed with you. It's a pretty serious thing to do. So in that sense, we do all wear it because Christ wears it when any one of us messes up. And we do all feel ashamed when one of us messes up. And we do all apologize and we make, as it were, a common act of contrition. Like at the start of every Mass, we all confess, even if we haven't done anything really bad since last time we've been at Mass, or maybe nothing bad at all. But we all confess because we're all in this together. And in some sense, we wear it and we care about it. Which doesn't mean I did it and that I should somehow be blamed for it, but it does mean that we've all got to take responsibility for purifying our church and for making our church the best church it can be, so that people really see we mean the gospel, we mean to be Jesus Christ in our world.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Grace, for your inspirational talk. You've been such an inspiration to me and I'm sure to everyone here. I just wanted to ask, Pope Francis met with the leader of the Orthodox Church over the week, and I wanted to know what your vision was for Christian unity in the future.
Were some of you at my installation? Some of you got in. I think a wonderful thing about my installation was we had leaders from every church and indeed from the major religions. The Grand Mufti of Australia was there, for instance, which has never happened before. There was a Jewish rabbi there. There's never been a Jewish rabbi at an installation of a Catholic Archbishop of Sydney. It really is a time in history when people of faith, at least some of them, are realising we have much more in common than we have differences. That whatever the little differences, for instance, between Catholic and Orthodox, they are tiny compared to so much we believe together, so much we could be doing together. And what a scandal it is to the world that we're still fighting, we're still divided. And Pope Francis really means it, as Pope Benedict did before him and Pope John Paul did before him and Pope Paul VI did before them. He really means it when he says to them, I want us to be one family. It is a cause of shame and a real countersign to our world that we still worship across the road from each other instead of together. That we still pass on to generation after generation divisions that go back 1,000 years and are really completely irrelevant to us today. Fights about the Crusades or about other things from a long time ago. Can't we put that behind us and go back to being the brothers and sisters Christ calls us to be? I really hope we'll see some significant advances and real unification between the Catholic and Orthodox churches in my life. That's certainly what Francis wants to see, and I'd love to see that in my life. And I'll be wanting to work for that to happen in Sydney to the extent we can in one locality.
I've got a question that actually came through a message. You've known three popes, Pope John Paul II, who made you a bishop, Pope Benedict, who sent you to Parramatta, and Pope Francis, who's now brought you to us in Sydney. Not many could say that they've had as much personal experience as popes as you've had. What would you say is your strongest memory or image of each of them?
You know, I have met popes quite a lot, and every time, like this time last week, I keep thinking someone's going to pinch me and wake me up. I'm going to realise it's all a dream. It's all a fantasy. It is a wonderful privilege to have known these men even a little bit. And John Paul I got to meet about a dozen times. I was very lucky. I've got so many memories of each one, but let me give you a little bit, an anecdote from each. When I met John Paul towards the end of his life, he was very frail by then. He was hardly speaking, in fact. He asked me how many religious there were in Australia and how religious life was going. I might have told some of you this story before, but forgive me. I'm reaching that age where I'm going to start telling my stories repeatedly. It goes with the charism of being an archbishop. And I said to him, well, I'm sorry to say, Your Holiness, but religious life in Australia is not doing so well. It's going down, down, down. The numbers are not good. And then he looked away and then he looked back at me and he said, how many kangaroos are there in Australia? And I thought, oh dear, he's very sick. He's very frail. At this stage, he was shaking terribly. He couldn't get up from his seat at all without help, without someone to lift him out of his seat. I thought, he's just wandering. It's probably the drugs. It's the Parkinson's. It's whatever's wrong. And I said, well, Holiness, I think there's something like 60 million kangaroos in Australia. And he looked at me very sharply, straight in the eye, and he said, with that kind of one-eye look that he had towards the end, I want more religious than kangaroos. And of course, he was joking with me, he was teasing me, but he was setting me a big challenge. He just made me a bishop, and now he was giving me part of my program. Now, if I to get 60 million, I'm going to have to import about nearly 40 million of them, or else I'm going to have to persuade some of the kangaroos to join religious orders. With Pope Benedict, when he arrived here in Australia for World Youth Day, one of the rewards you get for organising a World Youth Day is I got to have lunch with him on his first day in Australia. And it was quite surreal to be having lunch just sitting beside the Holy Father. And I really felt I'm going to wake up any moment, someone's going to shake me and wake me up, and it's just not going to be true. How could it be? He was a delight to talk to. He was charming, urbane. You got a sense this man could talk to anyone, to them, the most educated person, because he was one of the most educated men of the last century, to the most ordinary person. He could talk to them all, and they would all be comfortable with him. It was a lovely thing, what we call a gentleman. He was a gentleman, a gentleman. And I think we all experienced him. Some of you were probably still school kids. We all experienced him as a loving grandfather when he came to our country at the time of World Youth Day. And for many people, was as close up as they'll ever have got or will ever get to the Pope when he said Mass for us and loved us in that grandfatherly way in that time here in Sydney. I did get to bring him into Sydney Harbour on the front of a boat with him, everything blowing away, his hair and all his habit, which, you know, he wears a pretend Dominican habit, and was all blowing away like sails in a ship. And he had this huge grin on his face at the end of it, and he said, "That's a very good beginning." It was the start of World Youth Day. So, a lovely man and a genuinely holy, gentle man. And finally, Pope Francis. Well, I've hardly got to meet him. That tiny conversation I reported to you is all I've had with him so far. Hopefully, there'll be more ahead. I know I'm going to meet him in June next year when I get the pallium, the vestment the Pope gives to a Metropolitan Archbishop. And hopefully I'll get to have a few more words conversation, and I'll be able to tell him more about me than that I'm a Dominican that was educated by the Jesuits. But as you see there, he's a man that loves a joke, loves a tease, and that joy, that gospel joy he talks about, he lives it. He breathes it. It exudes from him. And again, I'd say, as I said before, about what a different city and nation this would be if we were all on fire with faith, hope and love. What a different city and nation this would be if we all exuded that gospel joy that our Holy Father does. And that's a challenge, I think, to every priest, to every bishop, to every religious, but I'd say to every one of us here. Could we try and be like that face to Sydney and to our world?
This is the final question for the night.
Thanks, Rebecca, for giving me the final question. Of course, this isn't the first time in the church where we have faced a situation where we need renewal. And in the past, it has been great saints who've cooperated with the grace of God to bring us the renewal that we've seen. What are some saints that have inspired you and should inspire us to cooperate with the grace of God, to really live out that radical call to holiness that we'll achieve, perhaps, love and responsibility on morning breakfast while we're sitting in our eco-friendly hovercrafts.
I've got lots of favourite saints. I've often been asked who are my favourite saints, and every time I give a different list because there's different ones that I've been reading or reading about just recently. But I suppose given what I'm wearing, I'm going to have to tell you about some Dominicans. Now, I've mentioned St. Dominic, so I won't give you him again. Thomas Aquinas. Now, he was a big, fat Dominican. And people thought he was dumb as a student at uni. And in fact, he turned out to be probably the most brilliant man in the history of humanity. Certainly the most brilliant theologian in the history of humanity. And what Thomas taught me is there's nothing more fascinating than God and the things of God. That it is endlessly interesting. People say, oh, religion, oh, that's kind of, that's old stuff, that's boring stuff. No, it's not. There's so much there. It's in the nature of mysteries that the more you plumb the depths, the more you discover there is to discover. And when you bring God into contact with people in the world, well, you've got it all. You've got everything that's interesting. You know, you hear people say, oh, can we just leave religion out of it? Let's leave out politics and religion. Well, what are you left with? Gossip? Movie stars? I mean, that's all right for about a minute. But the really big things, Thomas has taught me, that the real passions, the real things that matter, are about God and the things of God and the way they connect to God. St. Catherine of Siena was another Dominican. She's a woman, as the word Catherine might tell you. And she was a brilliant, courageous young woman. She just took on the world. What the issues were in her day, which included things like war and poverty and division in the church and corruption in the church, she took it all on. And she was determined to be an example of fidelity herself, and she called it like it was. She named it. There's one story I delight in of Catherine, where there's a politician she was trying to reform. She'd written him various letters. He did not change his way of life. So Catherine decided to go outside his house and preach to him out loud there. Now, the problem was for him, wherever Catherine went to talk, a crowd of a few thousand would gather. And so she was naming his issues very publicly. Naming and shaming, we'd call it. She was putting it up on the medieval internet. There it was, emblazoned on Siena's Facebook. 1450. And of course, he repented. Now, I don't know how deep the repentance was or whether he was just scared of the crowd and scared of Catherine, but he changed his life. And I think young people of passion, like that young woman, can change the world. She was the greatest woman of her age, the greatest person of her age. And yet she was just a simple woman. She began with not even being able to read. She learnt to read. She learnt to preach. She learnt to counsel. She ended up brilliant. And she did all that in 33 years. She died not much older than most of you, having done so much for the world. And my last Dominican to mention to you is Pier Giorgio Frassati, a 20th century Dominican, a recent Dominican, a lay man who was in the St. Vincent de Paul Society, in Catholic Action, but also in the Dominican laity. He was a uni student. He died at 24, I think, in his 20s anyway. So he had even less time than Catherine to make a difference. None of us knows how long we've got. So don't wait till tomorrow. Start making a difference tonight. He did it just in his 20s by being at uni, and he would do things like he would say to his friends when he was playing snooker with them, if I win, you'll come to Mass with me on Sunday. That was the bet, and he'd drag them along to Mass because he'd always win. Probably Christ gave him a bit of extra help. He had 101 ways of drawing people in. He had a secret life of helping the poor and the suffering. And the question I had earlier about our church being a church for the poor, that's the church he knew and lived. But there on the campus of the university, he was making a difference by just the friendships he made and the way he drew people like a magnet to God and the things of God. So there's three of my favourite saints. They just happen to be Dominicans. I'm a little one-eyed. Though I'm bishop for the whole Church of Sydney, not just for the Dominicans, let me be clear. You don't have to become a Dominican saint to be a saint. You can become a Franciscan saint or some other kind of saint, lay saint, married saint, doctor of the church. There's lots of choices for you out there. But one way or another, you've all got to be saints. If we're going to get there by 2035, I need you to be the saints for the 21st century. God bless you.
That was a Q&A session from Archbishop Anthony Fisher's talk, My Vision for Sydney, from Theology on Tap. Theology on Tap is held at Le Pub in Sydney CBD. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.